funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We feel so protective of the people we care about that many of us find it hard to bear when a loved one is in pain. Learning that somebody close to you has been deliberately seeking out physical injury can be both deeply upsetting and difficult to understand. But as my guest has learned, treating more than 300 patients with histories of hurting themselves, there is a right way to respond to such a discovery, one that can help those in crisis make progress toward healing in mind and body. Lori Vann is a licensed professional counselor and supervisor. Her new book is called A Caregiver's Guide to Self-Injury. Lori, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You write that you didn't really know much about this problem until you started your career in mental health. For people who don't know much about self-injury, haven't heard of it, can you explain, for purposes of this discussion, what we're talking about?
Well, the quick summary or definition that I give to it is the intentional infliction of harm on the body, usually for emotional reasons. And for self-injury, there are so many different types of it. It's not just cutting, it's burning, it's picking, it's scratching, it's hitting yourself or hitting objects and so many other variations of it.
So just to be clear, we're not talking about disorders where people might rhythmically hit their head against something because they're compelled for some other reason. This is for emotion, some kind of emotional relief?
Yes. Now, there are disorders where people are they have difficulty controlling it. It's a stereotypic type self-injury. And so that's where tic disorders or sometimes developmental disorders come into play. But for what we're talking about, this is intentional. They are knowingly doing this, and it is for emotional relief.
How does hurting yourself physically have the potential for some people to provide what feels like emotional relief?
It's a great question, and it's one of the most common that I receive. And it's that somehow the emotional pain is so bad for that individual that the physical pain is much easier to deal with for them. And I know for most people that sounds really odd, but that's the most consistent reply I've had. And I've treated almost 400 at this point. And that is the number one reason, that it's that release. It's an emotional release doing a physical act. We also know that there are endorphins that get released when we do something that's painful. So some actually get a high from it.
So do people just stumble upon this typically, or have they learned from someone else that this might be a source of relief for them?
It's a couple of different things. Now, a lot of people think, oh, well, they got it from their friend, that their friend's a bad influence. We just need to cut off all contact with that person. And while friends can be an influence, it's not the number one influence, because a lot of people do stumble upon it. It's just sort of they accidentally injured themselves in the shower cutting, or they hit something really hard and they realized, oh, there's a little bit of relief there. We have to look at the role of the media at this point, because references to self-injury have become so rampant in our music videos, in our television shows, in our movies, that people are getting influenced to do it from that too. Of you see a celebrity do it, or you see it depicted in a show and you go, well, maybe I should give that a try.
Are there common mental or psychiatric conditions that are comorbid with this kind of self-injuring behavior?
Yes. Most commonly what I've seen is major depression, but also all types of anxiety disorders, whether that be social anxiety disorder or social phobia is what used to be called, generalized anxiety disorder, PTSD, bipolar disorder. There's so many along that spectrum, but you're really looking at somewhere in the anxiety or the depressive or mood disorders as the most common.
So most people who engage in this do it in secret. Is that right?
That's correct. That it's a pretty shameful thing for them. They're embarrassed. They don't want the attention. They don't want to have to answer the questions, which then brings up when I have people go, well, what about this person? They seem to be showing off their injuries. And there are some that will do it for attention seeking, that they're wanting that response, that sympathy, which it's not to act in a negative way towards those individuals, because if they have to go that far to get attention, obviously they have problems. They need help. But the majority of those that injure do it very secretively. So then if it starts to, I guess they slip up, you could say, it may be at the point where they go, you know, I'm just so tired of trying to cover it up, that they just start being they start to slip up, basically, and they're not paying as much attention. And it almost is their passive way of saying, I want to get help, but I don't know how to ask for it. So maybe if someone sees this injury, maybe then they'll get the help for me, and that's a little bit less shameful.
What's the relationship, Lori, between self-injury and suicidal thinking?
There is definitely a correlation there. And correlation not being causation, but the large, large majority of clients I've worked with, that they have a history of suicidal ideation, if not suicide attempts. Now, self-injury is not a suicide attempt. It's really important to make that point, because a lot of people think that, oh, well, they cut on their wrist, that's a suicide attempt. And no, it's not. You have to ask them. So important. But what people have said is that if they didn't injure, then they would go to the suicide attempt. That's almost a preventative, basically, that this injury is my way of relieving my emotional pain. And if I don't have this to relieve it, much like someone runs to a bottle or to a pill, then they feel hopeless. And then they're much more likely to go to an attempt if you take away that coping skill for them.
So both of the things that you just said are really troubling. On the one hand, we have the troubling behavior of self-injury. On the other hand, if it is somehow, you know, standing in the way of someone really thinking seriously about committing suicide, it has to be handled delicately in order to help the person heal completely and also not need that release anymore.
It's absolutely a delicate issue. And probably one of the number one mistakes that I've had clients report to me of their loved ones or even professionals have made this mistake is to tell them to just stop it. Just don't do it. Which one shows a lack of understanding of the behavior, which then causes the person that's harming themselves to just shut down and go, you don't understand it. I can't talk to you about this anymore. I really have to deal with this on my own because you don't get it. But it's also realizing if you tell them to just stop it, but you've not given them alternatives and you've not given them the opportunity to really take on those alternatives and practice them, again, you are ripping away the one coping skill that they think that they have, and you've left them high and dry.
A lot of people assume that this is something that teenage white girls do, you know, upper middle class white girls of privilege. That is apparently not the case at all.
Absolutely not. Males do it. And I've talked with so many people and they're surprised by that they're like, oh, really? Well, what, just teenage boys? No, men injure as well. But it really goes across all demographics, all sociocultural, all races, all religions, all economics. I mean, it really is found in all of the different cultures throughout the world. You have cases that are in Japan, Sweden, not just Western Europe either, but you have ones that are in the Middle East. So it really is a global issue.
So where did this come from?
It's really been around for quite a long time. There's even a reference in the book of Mark towards an individual, and granted they were demon-possessed, but that his name was Legion and he used to cut himself with stones. It actually has that phrasing in there. And that we have historical figures that from the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, that's documented that they used to injure themselves. Now, way back when, we just thought, oh, well, they're psychotic, and we put them into an asylum. And it wasn't really discussed. It wasn't until probably the turn of the century, and I think Carl Menninger was one of the first to really say, you know what, self-injury is not a suicide attempt, and self-injury really doesn't mean they're psychotic. We really need to start looking at how we treat this. And so I think he's one of the first that got the ball rolling. But it still wasn't really discussed. It's really only been since probably the 1980s, and where the SAFE program came in is they really are the founders in self-injury treatment and helping people start to become educated about how to work with this.
I was interested to read that the first thing that's required for successful treatment is for the person who's doing the self-injuring to want to change. How do you get someone there if they feel like this is an effective coping mechanism and they, in their mind, say, well, it's not such a bad thing. I'm not going to kill myself with this. I'm just scratching my arm or I'm, you know, causing a burn or a bruise.
Well, I like to educate clients because I do have many that are brought in by relatives and basically have the fix them type of attitude, which counselors don't have a magic wand, as a note. So the client does have to have some level of motivation. And if they're not ready to give up the behavior, I go where they're at. And I say, you know what? I understand that. And I understand how connected you are to this. So some of it is just reflecting where they're at, maybe some of their fears about letting it go. But I try to work at the core issues because injury is just a behavior. It's just like substance abuse is a behavior or perfectionism or eating disorder. These are all acting out behaviors. You always have to get to the core issues that led to it. And self-injury can be addictive. And over the weekend, I was presenting at the West Coast Symposium on Addictive Disorders about how we really need to start looking at injury as part of the addiction profile. But anyway, I try to say, you know what, that's fine. I'll give you some coping skills and things I want you to try instead of and just start there. But let's get into the core issues. Why do you do this? What are the triggers? Is it that you have bad communication with your parents? Okay, well, let's start to talk about communication. And it's almost in an indirect way to get to the behavior, because if you deal with the core stuff, then the need for the behavior starts to go away.
It's important to, as you mentioned here, to talk about the behavior rather than the individual. You do not like the term cutter, as in so-and-so is a cutter.
That's correct. I really don't like the label part, and others that are working in this field, they're in agreement with as well. The problem with labels is it becomes their identity. And to go with most or many of them being adolescents, and we know during that stage of life, people are wanting to fit in. They want that label. They want to have some identity. So if you call them a cutter, then you've just given them an identity, which makes them more resistant to let that go, because if you have them stop injuring, then who are they? What group are they going to fit into? So you create an additional problem. But it's just, you know, it is a behavior. It's just as if someone is diagnosed with major depression. I don't want them to be that entire part of them. It's a part. It's not all of them. And that's a really clear distinction. Self-injury is a part of the individual. It is not the entire person. So to give them that label is almost making them sound like that's your entire persona.
Do most of your patients understand this better than the concerned loved ones who bring them in? Or do they see this as their identity?
Some do understand the concept of, yes, this is my identity, and that's why I'm resistant to change, because I at least have other people that I know do this, and I'm accepted. And the caregivers often have no clue that that's one of the reasons that they're doing this or why they're resistant to stop it.
We're speaking this hour with Lori Vann, who is a licensed professional counselor and supervisor and author of the new book, A Caregiver's Guide to Self-Injury. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to licensed professional counselor and supervisor Lori Vann, author of the new book, A Caregiver's Guide to Self-Injury. You could be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So, Lori, if someone's doing this and is trying to keep it secret, and you care about this person, how do you find out what's going on?
Well, and some of the guidelines I give of the signs of it, it's not just one in of itself is the really big red flag. So you want to take a whole big picture approach. But some of the things that you can look for are, well, do they seem like they're having a lot more accidents than usual? Because I'm an accident-prone person. I really should wear a helmet in day-to-day life and gloves and all the rest of it. But when you see any kind of patterns with the injury, it seems like, oh, it's always the forearm that's getting injured, or they're going through a lot more Band-Aids, or they're changing their clothing style. Because let's say in the Texas summer, if they're wearing long sleeves and pants, that's a little odd. It's way too hot for that. So a change in clothing style can be an indication. You see a change in mood, in attitude, and that would go along more on the depressive side, that they're withdrawing, want to keep to themselves. When you ask them about the injuries, they seem to be startled, or they get irritated or defensive, or it seems like they're always looking for that excuse. And you can also check the inside of their clothing, too, as you're doing the laundry. Are there blood spots in there? Are there blood spots on the towels, on the sheets, in the bathroom, in the grout? So there are lots of different things that you can look for that might be that heads up. There's something going on here.
You said a lot of times when parents will bring young people to you, they'll say, I think this only happened like one time, but I thought my child needed some help. And it's been your experience that that's rarely the case, that it happened one time in isolation.
That's correct. For many cases of self-harm, the person's been injuring since elementary school. And that's one of, I guess, the myths is that this is just a teenage thing. Well, for many of the cases, it started under age 12. It started in elementary school, but maybe it was picking or rubbing or scratching or hitting themselves. And then when those things didn't seem to work the same way to give them the same relief, then they start to escalate into perhaps cutting or burning. And at that point, maybe they're in junior high, so that's when it gets discovered. But the reality is they've actually been experimenting with it for many years prior to that. But even those that are supposedly caught the first time, rarely, really rarely has it been a one-time thing. Even for those, they've done it at least two or three times, and the parents just aren't aware of that.
Is there evidence that more young people experiment with this than actually make a habit of it, in the same way that people might experiment with drugs or alcohol and not go on to develop a problem?
I think that, yes, self-injury can be similar in substance use in that respect, or even with sometimes experimenting with eating disorders, that they may try it a couple times out of curiosity or because they heard someone do it, and so curiosity in that sense, and it either takes or it doesn't. And for whatever reasons, for some people, the self-injury, it takes for them. They're like, yeah, I'm getting some relief from this. Just like someone that might experiment with purging. Some do it once or twice and they go, oh, this is not for me. And others go, okay, I think I can actually use this as a tool and a way to deal with my emotions.
So I have to tell you, I can understand if parents discover this or suspect they discover this. I can understand the urge to flip out and to be really worried and to kind of, you know, I don't know, just let the child know that you're very, very concerned. Overreaction turns out to be a real mistake.
Yes. And I do want to say it's understandable. I completely understand a loved one flipping out because it is alarming. This is your loved ones, whether that be a spouse, because I've had those situations, or a friend or a grandchild or your child. This is someone that you love and you've raised them, and this is something you have no control over. And that the flip out response of either anger, because I've had plenty of those that they got really angry and accusatory and how could you do this to me? And one of the little notes there is their self-injury is not about you and you can't make it about you. This is about them and their choice. Or, you know, the stereotypical mom, the gnashing of teeth, the busting out in tears and histrionics and just saying all sorts of things that probably shouldn't say. And I understand those responses. So what I would advise caregivers to do, and this applies for even professionals, that they're not quite sure how to react to it. It's better to say, okay, thank you for sharing this with me. I need to go in my room and I just need to think about this. I just need to process this because I want to make sure I say the right thing. And even though that might be a little stilted or awkward, it's a much better option than just saying whatever comes to your mind in that moment.
Another response parents might have is, or spouses or whatever, is, you know, throwing away all the razor blades in the house or making sure there are no matches or whatever, whatever, you know, paraphernalia people have used to self-injure. You've said that until the individual is motivated to try to do something about this, there's nobody has enough control to keep people from self-injuring.
It's very true. And one of the consistent things I say in my presentations or my seminars is that where there's a will, there's a way. And repeatedly that has been shown. People that have been inpatient, they have found very creative ways to harm themselves. And in the book, I list out just some of the methods. In my seminar, it's a full 3 or 4 slides that document all the creative things that I have heard. So it's an impossible task. What I'll tell people is think of Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs when he was wheeled into the airplane hangar and he's in the 5-point restraints. He's in that full jacket. He has the mouth guard over him or that mask and the bite block and he's just fully contained. But I would say you'd have to then go to the next level and wrap each finger individually. And you would have to have the bite block in the mouth because otherwise they could bite their tongue, they could bite the inside of the cheek, they could bite their lip. And I've had people do all those things. Or they can take their individual fingers and put their fingernails into their skin and they get some relief or pain that way. So unless you're going to go to that extreme, you cannot stop someone from self-injuring.
Okay, as depressing as that sounded, what does therapy look like?
Therapy first has to start in a non-judgmental place. And would say that if you're looking for a counselor, you need to ask the questions because not all counselors are equipped to deal with this. Not all are comfortable working with this. And this is a specialty area, just like substance use or eating disorders or many other things. So you need to ask the questions of what is your experience level? How many cases have you worked with? What is your training? What research have you done? And really making sure that person is comfortable working with this kind of population.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's take a call now from Pam in Euless. Hi, Pam.
Hi. Thank you so much for talking about this. I'm really nervous, so I'm sorry if I'm talking too fast.
You sound fine.
I cut myself when I was a teenager, but not very badly, deeply, or very much. And then it kind of went away. And then when I was in my 30s, my father died and my grandfather died within 8 weeks of one another. And I lost it. And I went to therapy and started dealing with issues. And as the issues came up, I started cutting myself to relieve the pain. And the more I cut, the more the pain was relieved. And one day I cut myself so badly that I thought I couldn't stop the bleeding. And my husband just reached out to grab my arm to, you know, like say, hey, come this way. And I fainted. And that sort of was the beginning of change for me. I realized I had a choice. I could be in pain. And I could choose to do this or I could find other ways to deal with it. And then right after that, I became pregnant. And so at that point, it wasn't an option. I just had to take best care of myself, continue therapy. And but even now at 55, 21 years later, every once in a while, I still think about it. I'm not going to lie.
Well, Pam, thank you so much for sharing your story. I really appreciate it. It sounds like you really have done amazing work to take care of yourself, and I'm sure it's still a struggle. Is there anything you want to respond to there, Lori?
Well, her experience is not uncommon because I have had several women that they may have done it as teenagers or whatever form it may have been, cutting or otherwise, and then there'll be a break. Could be several decades of a break, and then something happens, and because those core issues weren't dealt with or they didn't really develop some other coping skills, then they return to self-injury. So I have had several of those cases and even have had adult males that have mentioned that too.
We have an email here from Peggy in Garland who asks, is tattoo collecting related to self-injury? Given that this process is often chosen by prisoners and soldiers, and since it's very painful, is this a socially acceptable way to self-injure and then show off that pain while also recalling the memory of it?
It's a great question, and I get that a lot. I touch a little bit on it in the caregiver's book. I go into a lot more detail in the practitioner's guide to the treatment of self-injury. And it depends on the intent. That's what a lot of it comes down to, is what is their intent behind the tattoo? And if the intent is, well, I like the pain, I like the rush that I get, then that's on the self-injury side. If they keep finding excuses to get more and more of them, then that can be a red flag. Maybe this is self-injury. If they have a history of self-harm, then they stop, let's say, cutting or burning, and then it seems like they've transitioned to tattoos, that could be another warning sign of it. How do they react to the piercings? I would throw that in there as well, to the piercing or tattoo. Is it something they really want to show off and they take pride in, and it's something very meaningful and symbolic? Or is it, well, yeah, I did this, or, well, yeah, I got that piercing, I'm going to let it grow back, and where you get a sense of it was really impulsive and maybe emotionally based. So those are just some of the distinguishing factors between the two.
The challenging thing about that is I think we all these days know people who walk around with a lot of tattoos, and they are proud of them and they love them. Mm-hmm. We don't want to make the assumption that everyone who has chosen to get tattoos or multiple piercings is mentally compromised in some way.
Absolutely, because some people just really like the artwork of it. For some people, it's their identity. It's the group that they want to connect with. So again, you have to get back to that intent behind why did they get it in the first place. But I have had several people that have moved from the self-injury into getting tattoos as their replacement form of injury, and that is their stated intent, or the same thing with the piercings.
All right, let's talk about the internet. Many people have heard about these groups of people who are in great pain, helping each other be better anorexics, and these exist for self-injury as well.
It's true. Back in November, I actually did a presentation for the Family Matters Conference called The Cutting Edge of Technology, and it was discussing how much information is out there on self-harm. You Google it, and how many probably a million references pop up. You go to YouTube, and I know there are over 100,000 videos on YouTube of it at least being mentioned. Now, to be fair, I can say some of those were from counselors. I know that some of my past interviews are on YouTube, and so obviously the search engine will be injury. But there are some that depict actually doing the act. If you go to Tumblr, Facebook, Twitter, any of the social media accounts, while they say, well, we don't support it, and please let us know if there are boards or whatnot that are pro, the reality is that they really don't get regulated. And as soon as you set up a rule, they're going to find a way around it. They're creative in that sense. So unfortunately, there are plenty of spots on the internet, whether through social media or just boards or just websites, where they can get ideas of what to do.
Is there any relationship whatsoever between a history of self-injury and a greater than average likelihood of acting out physically against other people?
Not necessarily. That's the interesting part with self-injury, is that they act out on their own bodies, because I guess you'd say the stereotypical person that harms has low self-esteem, that they're not assertive, they tend to be a people pleaser, they tend to have boundary issues. And so that's one of the problems with the emotional pain, is instead of being assertive and confronting that individual and say, hey, I'm mad at you, they take it out on their own body. So I've not come across a significant number that they get physically aggressive with other people. Now, there are some that will, but most of the time they take it out on their own body.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Stephen is on the line in Irving. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well,
thanks for this topic. It's really helpful. I recently got married to someone who has a history of, you know, depression, anxiety, some eating disorders, and, you know, kind of in getting to know them better, I realized they have some tendencies towards, you know, usually scratching or, you know, biting themselves in moments when they're very, very upset. And I think as a spouse, sometimes it's very difficult to know how to deal with it, to know how to cope with it, to know, you know, sometimes you hold back from conversations or try to, you know, be overly sensitive or don't bring things up. And then as well, you know, I think that, I guess what I'm asking about is, you know, what are some coping mechanisms? I think what I've, I mean, I've tried to sympathize, or I've tried to kind of physically kind of get in the way or intervene when, you know, I can kind of see she's getting anxious. And I just, I guess, as a, you know, what advice would you give to a spouse in these kinds of situations?
Thanks for your call.
Well, one, it sounds like you are really trying to do the right things for her, that you're not trying to be judgmental, you're not trying to solve the problem for her, that being supportive, having unconditional love is a big part of it. Now, oftentimes those that self-harm because they have the low self-esteem, and many of them do have an abuse history, whether that be emotional, physical, or sexual, or neglect, that they feel undeserving of the love. So, you know, I would encourage her to try to get her own individual counseling if she's not currently getting it, to deal with not just potential injury, but a lot of those other related issues you mentioned. Now, for spouses, I do offer a caregivers support group. It's caregivers of those that self-harm. And that might be a good outlet, but you can also consider your own individual counseling just to get some extra tips and to de-stress.
Lori Vann is my guest. She's a licensed professional counselor and supervisor. Her new book is called A Caregiver's Guide to Self-Injury. We'll talk more about this in a couple of minutes. You can join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org. You can call 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the author of A Caregiver's Guide to Self-Injury. Lori Vann is a licensed professional counselor and supervisor. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Liz, who says she's 29 years old. Liz says, I've been struggling since I was a small child with picking at scabs. My arms and legs are covered in them. There appears to be very few experts out there and none in my insurance network. Even though it's self-harm, I don't feel like it's triggered by life issues. I just do it helplessly. Are there resources out there for someone like me?
Well, I would wonder if it doesn't fall into the category of trichotillomania, which it gets to be a very tricky thing differentiating between self-injury, non-suicidal self-injury is the official title for it, versus trichotillomania. And one of the differences that can pop up is that the awareness factor. So with self-injury, there's usually the trigger, there's an intent, the person is aware of what they're doing. With trichotillomania, it can be more of an unconscious thing, it's more compulsive, that there's not necessarily a trigger, even though anxiety and stress tend to trigger the episodes for that, but it's much more compulsive in nature. But it's not necessarily something they're really thinking, oh, I want to hurt myself. So that might be something to look into if you haven't already. There is a trichotillomania support group that is in Dallas, run by a woman named Susanna, and I think they meet once a month. I know of a therapist up in Denton, Judy DeCoon. She works with trichotillomania. And then I work some with that, but also obviously the self-injury component. And I know of many different counselors that I've trained personally, either through my seminars or as interns, that work with self-harm.
For people who want to Google this, trichotillomania is
T-R-I-C-H-O-T-I-L-L-O-M-A-N-I-A.
Okay. So just if you want to Google it, it's, it starts with a T-R-I-C-H.
Yes.
And you can go from there. All right. Okay, so if anxiety and depression are often associated with these behaviors, Lori, do medications help?
Medications can help. Now, it's important to understand there's no set medication that's for self-injury. There's not been one that said this is the one. And also, to be realistic about medications, they don't solve problems. Medication's purpose is to help get the emotions, the symptoms a little bit more in check so that you can do the cognitive work, do the behavioral work. But medications were never designed to be the perfect little pill that solves the problem. You still got to do the work. I'm not a medical doctor, but there are some different medications I've seen be prescribed in relation to self-harm. Some of them are off-label uses, and some go with the anxiety component. So your standard Prozac and Zoloft I've seen prescribed oftentimes.
But those alone are not going to do it. What you're saying almost sounds like getting a pain reliever before physical therapy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, if someone is severely depressed, you have to deal with a major depressive disorder. If they're having lots and lots of anxiety and they can't even go to school or to work because they're so anxious, yes, you need to have a medication to help calm down those symptoms. But then it's almost how I describe it is the emotional side is way out in front, and the medications help get those symptoms and emotions a little bit more in check so that the cognitive side, which has been in the back seat, can come forward and then be able to do the work.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Jan on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jan.
Hi. My question is, as a school counselor working with teenage girls, middle school particularly, I have found that it seems like sometimes this cutting behavior can be almost contagious among the girls, and where it is almost a cool thing to do within certain groups, to be accepted, to be liked. How do you find best to address that?
So agreed that it does seem to become contagious, and I've heard that from many school counselors. And if you think about it, especially in middle school, they are trying to find their identity. They're at the very start of that identity versus role confusion if you go by Ericksonian guidelines. So, and this gets to be the problem with using a label such as cutter, because then you're really feeding into that this is our group and you have to do it to fit in with our group. With any bad behavior, it's just more of a divide and conquer of working with them individually and helping them find other things that they can associate with. So if some of them are in the performing arts or they're in the art department or they're in athletics, trying to get that to be played up a little bit more. It's also helping them understand that there are some people they really don't need to hang out with because they're unhealthy individuals, but they also have to look at their own unhealthy issues too. Understanding that, unfortunately, for a lot of school counselors, it's triage work. You get maybe 15 minutes with them. It's patch up the wound, send them back to the classroom. Now, there are some school districts where school counselors actually get to be school counselors and help them with the process. But it's a very difficult position to be in. And it is encouraging them to find support groups to get their parents involved, because the parents need to be involved with this and see what they're doing to help the girl with or boy with their self-esteem. But also, what are they doing on the home front that may be unintentionally exacerbating this? So people go to groups because they want to fit in, and it's so apparent in junior high. So you have to do this. Let's find other ways they can fit in and help them. Again, focus on where self-esteem should actually come from.
What do you say to parents of a child who is emotionally healthy, that has a best friend who is doing this? You know, you talk about maybe not hanging out with someone who's not emotionally healthy, and yet probably the last thing that kid needs at that point is to have his or her friends walk out.
Agreed. And it's one of the things I discuss in the caregiver's guide, because I've had plenty of situations where one parent or a parent found out that their kid's hanging out with someone that's doing this, and it's the instant you can't talk to them, sever the relationship, period, which is damaging for the healthier child, because that's punishing them for what someone else is doing. But it's very, very damaging for the person that's self-harming, because that's going to reinforce, I'm a horrible person, and now I'm really alone. And to me, that becomes a risk factor for suicide attempts, because now they're ostracized. So the better recommendation is to, one, become educated about injury, and to know that just because your child's friend does it doesn't automatically mean your child is going to do it. But you have to actually sit down and have a discussion with them and talk with them about, how do you understand injury? You know, you're not responsible for your friend's behavior. And really understanding boundary setting is a key part, because we're not responsible for other people's actions. Those are their decisions. And we're not there to solve their problems. We can't take on their junk. And that's something that adults struggle with, but especially adolescents struggle with that.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Rachel on the line in Arlington. Hey, Rachel.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a history of self-injury, and I have recently noticed in my four-year-old son, when he's having a typical preschooler meltdown, that he has begun hitting himself. And it's sadly familiar to me. And I'm wondering, is this an indicator of a future of self-injury? And what can I do for him in the moment? How can I help him best?
Well, role modeling does take place with any behaviors, whether good or bad, that parents do have to be aware of how they are role modeling stress or anxiety or anger management, because kids are little sponges and they are so very observant, and they pick up on things we say and our actions. So for him, hitting himself is not an absolute slam dunk. He's going to go down this path. However, regardless, we want to make sure that he understands hitting himself is not appropriate, or hitting objects is not appropriate. So we want to help them calm down and say, okay, little Johnny, tell me how are you feeling? Why are you upset? Why did you hit that? And really, the more we can teach kids words, and even if it's on a really basic level, you could get a flip chart of emotions and have them point to a picture of how they're feeling, it's a great start. Because one of the consistent things that pops up with self-injury, and it's actually goes along with the title of a book, A Bright Red Scream, is that most people that self-harm don't know how to properly communicate. So they're using their bodies to try to communicate messages. So the earlier we can learn words and emotions and how to articulate them, the better we may be at healthier life management.
What's the best way to initiate a conversation about this with family members, in particular children and teenagers, who appear to be fine, but who we just want to take the pulse of?
Well, I think it's a discussion to have with anyone, because the reality is by the time a child graduates high school, they know at least one, if not many, people that have self-harmed. That's just the reality of it. I had done a girls' camp back in the fall, and I don't know, about 50 girls, and asked them, okay, how many of you know someone that self-harms? And over 90% of them raised their hand.
So we're not planting an idea in their heads if we have the conversation.
No. Oh, absolutely not. It's just like with the suicide thing. We're not planting the idea. We can't tiptoe and think, oh, well, what if? The more you avoid a subject, the more appealing it becomes to them, the more curiosity is there. We want to guide them in that curiosity by giving them actual answers, facts. We want them to feel that they can have that discussion with us, and we're not going to freak out, and we're not going to be judgmental, that it really is a discussion. And so you need to address this with them, just like you need to address dating violence. Well, what do you think you would do if this started to happen to you? Or how have you handled knowing one of your friends might be harming? Well, what are your thoughts about it? But it's very important to be non-judgmental, very casual, very conversational, because the kid's going to be a little freaked out probably. If they're not used to talking with you and this is a new thing, they're probably going to be a little hesitant and go, what's the catch? That I'm walking into something here. So you're going to have to be real consistent with, no, it's just casual conversation. If they don't really want to discuss it then, revisit it later on. But just don't, you know, wash your hands, go, oh, well, I tried to bring it up once. They didn't want to talk about it, so did my part. It's not how it works.
What do we do when we have strong reason to suspect that somebody else's child, somebody else's spouse is engaging in these behaviors? Is it best to first talk to the individual before we go to the people that take care of them?
It's a very difficult situation. And I think that as a common courtesy, as a sign of respect, it's best to go to the individual first that you suspect may be doing it. And again, the approach is going to be very important. And I would encourage people to talk with a professional first as, hey, these are my suspicions. This is what I'm seeing. Am I on the right track here? Is this possibly injury? And then how should I best talk to them about it and approach it? Because you want to make sure to say the right things. You want to have the right attitude, the right tone, because their automatic response is going to be denial of, oh, no, I don't know what you're talking about. And they might get defensive. And how are you going to handle that if you have that type of reaction? But we have to be careful not to take the control from another person, because that's one of the things that comes up with injury is they feel so out of control, but what they do to their body, they do have control over. So if you're going to out me on injury, that's one more thing you're taking control from versus saying, hey, I would be with you if you wanted to go to a counselor. I would sit in the waiting room with you. I would sit in that office if you wanted me to. And just start from there of showing that unconditional support of, I'm not judging you, I just care about you. And hey, if you want to talk about this with your spouse, then I will be glad to help you with that. Not giving advice, just sitting in.
We just have about 30 seconds left, but have you seen patients get fully out on the other side of this, people who have struggled with this problem and then really feel like they are healed at some point?
Absolutely. I've worked with many people that self-harm, and some of them just sort of grow out of it, as it were, but you still need the intervention to make sure they grow out of it. And then many that have worked through those core issues, and we've built that healthy foundation, and they just don't have the need for it anymore.
Lori Vann is a licensed professional counselor and supervisor. Her new book is called A Caregiver's Guide to Self-Injury. Lori, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. On Twitter, I am at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.